Counsels of Perfection for Christian Mothers by the Very Reverend P. Lejeune, Honorary Canon of the Cathedral of Rheims, Archpriest of Charleville. Translated with the author's permission by Francis A. Ryan. Nihil Obstat, F. J. Holweck, Censor Librorum, St. Ludovici, the 21st of October, 1913. Imprimatur by John J. Glennon, Archiepiscopal St. Ludovici, 21st of October, 1913. Copyright 1913 by Joseph Gummersbach. Part First, The End, Obstacles. Counsels of Perfection, Chapter 1, True and False Devotion. My daughters, you all aspire to perfection, but what is your idea of perfection? Do you not often use this word in a vague and even false sense? It trips so lightly into your conversation that each one prides herself on having a very clear conception of it. I am positive, however, that if I were to ask you to divine this word, the response would be a confusion of tongues. Perfection is frequently attributed to persons who assume strained attitudes and an affected bearing. Now this notion of perfection is erroneous. For these strained attitudes and this affectation, far from constituting true perfection, are but counterfeits of it. For many, perfection consists in an invariable series of prayers. They consider it a crime to fail to make the sign of the cross, to omit one of the multiple invocations to some saint in paradise, or to cut short a novena or some other pious practice. The laws of justice, the injunctions of charity, the rules of prudence, humility, and modesty are elements of perfection to which these people give not the slightest concern. This type of devotee is by no means new. It flourished even in the days of our Savior. You may recall to mind the Pharisees whom Jesus reproached for straining the gnat and swallowing the camel. The author of the Imitation severely rebukes those who center all their devotion on books, images, and exterior signs and symbols. I'm not sure that some of you are not given to this whimsical and purely exterior piety. Some of you perhaps permit your interior life to lie fallow because you have in your rooms an altar of the Blessed Virgin or the Sacred Heart arranged with taste and adorned with the fairest flowers of the season. Let us smile and pass on. Here is another error. We find it among those honest but short-sighted people who insist upon viewing the spiritual life from one side only. This error lies in identifying perfection with macerations and corporeal penances. According to this view, he alone reaches the highest degree of perfection who can best submit to the blows of discipline or to long-continued fasts. Now, I have often read that sanctity adapts itself admirably to ordinary life and does not at all entail the extraordinary and terrifying attendance of corporeal penances. If this be our idea of perfection, then our idea is not correct. Let us read a passage from St. Francis de Sales in which he describes with his usual grace all the counterfeits of perfection. You must first know that what the virtue of devotion is, for since there is but one true devotion and many which are false and deceitful, if you cannot distinguish that which is true, you may easily deceive yourself in following some fantastical and superstitious devotion. As Aurelius painted all the faces of his pictures to the resemblance of the woman he loved, so everyone paints devotion according to his own passion and fancy. He that is addicted to fasting thinks himself very devout if he fasts, though his heart be at the same time filled with rancor, and scrupling to moisten his tongue with wine or even with water, through sobriety, he makes no difficulty to drink deep of his neighbor's blood, as it were by detraction and calumny. Another considers himself devout because he recites daily a multitude of prayers, though immediately afterwards he utters the most disagreeable, arrogant, and injurious words against his domestics and neighbors. Another cheerfully draws money out of his purse to relieve the poor, but cannot draw meekness out of his heart to forgive his enemies. Another readily forgives his enemies, but never satisfies his creditors except by constraint. These may be esteemed devout by some, but in reality they are by no means so. When Saul's servants sought David in his house, Michal, laying a statue in his bed and covering it with his clothes, made them believe it was David himself. Thus many persons, by covering themselves with certain external actions, make the world believe that they are truly devout, whereas they are in reality nothing but statues and phantoms of devotion. Having pointed out the counterfeits of perfection, I must now proceed to give a precise definition of it. But you must remember that it is exceedingly difficult to shape a definition which can be applied to all natures without exception. The saints, judging them on the surface, differ vastly in their ideas of perfection. The severe Saint Jerome, for example, seems to have a very remote relation to the sweet Saint Francis de Sales. Saint Aloysius Gonzaga and Saint Stanislaus, delicate flowers that expanded in the peace and regularity of the religious life, bear but little resemblance to Saint Francis Xavier, who, proceeding from the most daring explorers, traversed the world to win kingdoms for Jesus Christ. If I study the writings of the saints, if I recall the words that fell from their lips, and strive from these to form an idea of true perfection, I am again plunged into perplexity. I hear Saint Francis of Assisi preaching, "Be ye poor, this is perfection." I hear Saint Francis de Paul repeating, "Be ye charitable, this is perfection." I hear the Abbe de Rancy, the austere reformer of the Trappists, saying, "Be ye mortified, this is perfection." So I might heap up citation upon citation, but these will suffice to show how difficult it is to arrive at a formula for perfection which will fit all the saints, determine the common trait which permits us to classify all under one head, and enables us to say of each one, "Here is a saint." My daughters, I trust that the definition of perfection which I shall give will sink deeply into your hearts. Perfection is accomplishing the will of God in a constant and generous fashion. That person then is perfect who does at every instant what God wishes. Ask her at any moment what she is doing, and she will always respond, "That which God wishes." If a response other than that be obtained from her, for example, "I am doing what pleases myself," or some other creature, then you have the right to say, "This person is not perfect." Do you ask for an example of a perfect woman? I shall give it you from the heavenly hierarchy by recalling the life of Mary, who in the matter of perfection is the nearest approach to God. She it is whom I charge to prove my thesis in such a way that you will be clearly persuaded that sanctity does not at all consist in splendor or magnificence or the glitter of exterior things, but rather in an interior principle which animates the most ordinary actions and communicates to them an almost inestimable value. Consider for a moment the life of Mary. What do you find rare or extraordinary in that life? It was the life of a plain Judean woman in the century of Augustus. It was spent in the monotony of the most commonplace occupations. We see Mary as a child growing up pious and pure under her mother's care. We see her as a young maiden, espousing a workman. We see her as a mother watching over her slumbering infant. We see her as a housewife preparing food for the husband and the son returning from their labors. Yet this woman is holy, incomparably holier than all the saints taken together, holy with a holiness before which all other holiness pales, as the light of the stars pale when the sun rises above the horizon. I challenge anyone to find another explanation of Mary's sanctity than this. Mary was accomplishing the will of God at every moment of her life, and the perfect love with which she accomplished that will constituted the measure of her sanctity. Moreover, this rule can be applied to all the saints. Do not invoke the name of Sir Francis Xavier because he won kingdoms for Jesus Christ. Do not invoke the name of Saint Vincent de Paul because he gathered all the wretched under the folds of his robe. Do not invoke the name of Saint John Baptist de La Salle because he permitted his love for children to develop into heroism. If Saint Francis had baptized the Japanese and the Indians without the command of God, he would not be holy. If Saint Vincent de Paul had sheltered all the suffering under his robe without the command of God, he would not be holy. If Saint John Baptist de La Salle had, without divine command, sold his goods and renounced all dignities in order to become master of a school, he would not be holy. It was the will of God realized by them and accomplished in them that made these men saints. Thus understood, perfection no longer appears to us as the privilege of the few. There are no professions in which it is allied to the exclusion of other professions. There are no countries to which it adapts itself to the exclusion of other countries. It is for all times, for all countries, and for all states and professions. Whatever may be your station in life, whether you were born of poor parents, like our Savior, or whether you spring from a family where ease and even opulence reigns, it matters little. Remember that perfection can and ought to harmonize with every state and condition. The outline of perfection which I have sketched in this chapter does not originate with me. I have taken it from the words of the Savior, who, far from designating certain individuals, says to us all, "Be ye perfect." Let me recall to your minds that beautiful prayer which a holy princess, Madame Elizabeth, daughter of a king and sister of Louis XVI, made each morning of her life, and I charge you to repeat it every day, if not verbatim, at least in its general sense. My God, what will happen to me today I do not know, but I do know that nothing will happen to me which Thou hast not foreseen and ordained for my greater good. I accept, then, Thy thrice holy will. I submit myself to it, and desire to delight in it, despite all the revolts of my reason and the repugnances of my nature. Chapter 2. A Catalogue of Souls. What is the state of my soul? What place do I occupy with regard to God in the great family of Christian souls? These, my daughters, are questions to which you must not be indifferent. In order to furnish you with the elements of a response to these questions, I intend to draw up a catalogue of souls which will enable you to determine to what category you belong. My purpose, I must avow, is not solely to satisfy your curiosity. When you know just where your place is in this catalogue, you should aspire to a higher degree of excellence in the hierarchy of souls. It is my purpose to guide you in your upward march, to point out the halting places along the way, and to indicate the means by which you can arrive most quickly and most surely at the coveted goal. A preliminary observation. The catalogue that I shall draw up is not at all concerned with those who live in the state of habitual mortal sin. I write for those earnest Christians who, to say the least, never commit a grave fault. If someone among my readers should be so unfortunate as to live continually at enmity with God, this poor soul would be an object to weep over and to pray for, but not to delay upon. What principle is to guide us in our classification of souls? Which one of our faculties will instruct us as to the state of our souls and authorize us to decide, without fear of error, whether this or that soul is ill or well? Let us interrogate successfully our three chief faculties, the sensibility, the intelligence, and the will. Will the sensibility instruct us infallibly as to the state of a soul? No. The sensibility is a faculty which deceives us, even in the ordinary affairs of life, and which in our relations with God baffles all our calculations and evades all our previsions. For example, today you feel that your affection for some person you love is much less lively than yesterday, and you are at a loss to account for this. You may have done nothing which, to your knowledge, might produce this effect. So in the affairs of piety you will experience vacillations, yet more pronounced, and yet not less inexplicable. Today, full of ardor and prayer, you open your soul before God without the least effort, and experience a deep feeling of love for Him. Tomorrow your prayers seem but empty words which your sensibility disavows. Evidently your sensibility has undergone a change, but has the state of your soul changed? Not at all. In the eyes of God you are the same as you were yesterday, despite your seeming lukewarmness. It is not to the sensibility, then, that we must have recourse when we wish to determine our place in the catalogue of souls. To take this faculty for our guide would be to expose ourselves to innumerable disappointments. We should be great saints at times when our hearts beat more lively in prayer than is customary with us, but we should be the worst miscreants when we prayed without relish and happiness. Are you not aware, my daughters, that the majority of the saints had to endure this absence of sensible relish, and these vacillations of the sensibility, which in their relations with God brought them agony and torture rather than joy? We may well believe them when they tell us that in prayer they were beasts of burden before God. But was their prayer less meritorious and efficacious because it was not accompanied by sensible joy? The sensibility, then, is a faculty which we cannot be too distrustful of when we desire to render to ourselves an account of our standing with God. Is the intelligence our infallible guide? Does the vigor of our spiritual life depend upon this faculty? It would, if to know good were to be good. But how frequently we find those of enlightened intelligence satisfied to let their morality consist mainly in desire. It is so seldom that we love God in the measure in which we know Him. It is not at all impossible to have a consummate knowledge of religion and the spiritual life, to be a light for others and yet resemble the guidepost which points the way, but itself remains immovable. Moreover, would it be just for our spiritual vitality to be in proportion to the various lights which God gives us? There are some on whom God has bestowed light sparingly. There are others on whom He has shed it abundantly. But what is light? It is but the means of knowing good. Thus each one is held to do good in the measure in which she comprehends it. Abundance of light, then, is a gift for which we shall be judged more severely by God. And if we bring to His tribunal an intelligence rich in light, and a life poor in merits, we may well be fearful. It is not to the intelligence you must look, therefore, in order to ascertain the state of your spiritual life. There remains now the will. How is your will disposed towards God? Is your will united to the will of God? Do you wish what God wishes, the least important things as well as the most essential? Do you make some reserve, yielding to the divine will on one point and opposing it on another? These, my daughters, are questions the import of which you will at once appreciate, questions which are of capital significance for you. It is indeed true that the will is the important faculty in the spiritual man. Hence it is that Catholic theology styles the sinful soul a will turned away from God, and the fervent soul a will which adheres to God. Moreover, recall the definition of perfection which we have given in the preceding chapter. Perfection consists in accomplishing the will of God in a constant and generous fashion. Thus it follows that we withdraw from or approach perfection according as we shun the divine will or adhere more generously to it. We have at hand then the solution of our problem. The will must teach us the state of the soul. What is the attitude of my will relative to God? When I have responded to this question, I know what the state of my soul is. I can classify my soul. I can tell to what category it belongs. The principle which we have just laid down will permit a classification of souls which I trust will be satisfactory to my readers. First, those whose souls are lukewarm and who accept only the struggle against mortal sin. Second, those whose souls are fervent and who not only struggle against venial sin, but also undertake to reform themselves. Third, those whose souls are very fervent and who are habitually disposed to refuse God nothing. The first of these three categories calls for some remarks. The signs of lukewarmness are indicated by the general rules which I have laid down. I have found them well drawn out in a fine passage taken from one of the works of Pierre Genassou on the spiritual exercises of St. Ignatius. Signs of lukewarmness. To have little or no regard for venial sin, and to fear only mortal sin. To perform one's spiritual exercises out of a spirit of routine or human respect, with disgust and with negligence reflected upon and consented to pray habitually without attention, to confess one's faults lightly without the serious resolution of avoiding them, to communicate without devotion by not striving to obtain it, to perform one's daily actions without the proper intention, without order or method, to be given over to exterior things, to be rarely present to oneself, and yet more rarely to have God present, to renounce the exercise of great virtues, even those whose practice is suited to one's state or profession, to be content with a state of mediocrity, to shun the company of those who work with ardor for their perfection, to seek the company of those who are more dissipated, less fervent, and less regular, to form an erroneous conscience, the cause of which superiors and directors often attribute to lack of good judgment, to employ false principles to silence remorse, to nourish, despite the frequent use of the sacraments, interior aversions, jealousies, movements of pride, and particular and dangerous affections, to encourage a spirit of harshness, insubordination, and cavilling, which manifests itself in offensive and contentious words, to entertain continually a secret self-love, which, mingling in all its actions, corrupts and infects them with its virus. Lastly, to shirk whatever entails labor and self-abnegation, and to seek rather for comforts, futile consolations, and ease. From this simple statement, you can tell to what category you belong. After having read the chapters that will follow, you will be yet more capable of judging, will better understand how one can pass from one of these states into the other. Very happy should I be if this study would stimulate those among you who are lukewarm to march with a resolute step to the conquest of fervor, and should inspire those already fervent with a desire to mount higher and still higher in fervor and love. Chapter 3, Naturalism. My daughters, permit me to denounce, under the name of naturalism, a widespread evil of our day, an evil that infects the soul in various ways. Surely you are not ignorant of the vast difference between the soul of the Christian and the soul of the pagan. The will and intelligence of the Christian have received a new life, superadded to that of nature, and called for that reason the supernatural life. Analyze the intelligence of the Christian, and you will see that it is formed and fashioned in an entirely different way than the intelligence of the pagan. You will find there certain truths which reason itself could not have discovered, and a unity of conviction and judgment that has not sprung from natural causes. Apply yourselves with the same earnestness to the study of the Christian's will. You will obtain the same results. You will behold this will loving persons and things to which the will of the pagan is indifferent. For example, you will see the supernatural man regarding the sacred host with love, and the natural man casting only a vacant glance upon it. The soul of the Christian is cast in a supernatural mold. The supernatural life is its foundation. Hence, the supernatural ought to rule our thoughts and be the principal inspiration of all our actions. Now there are certain Christians who live continuously in the state of grace and observe the chief precepts of religion, but who, in the ordinary course of their lives, do not differ notably from pagans. In their mode of appreciating persons and things, they manifest sentiments which have nothing of the supernatural in them. Their souls have remained partly pagan. We are right, then, in characterizing by the name of naturalism the evil in which they are tainted. Although their souls have received a new life, these persons think, feel, and act as if they were yet in the life of nature. My daughters, some of you may be forced to confess that your souls are yet pagan-like. Perhaps a truly Christian education has been denied you, and the atmosphere of religious indifference in which you have lived has left its stamp upon you. Perhaps you have permitted the fire of that Christian life, which burned so brightly in your earlier years, to die out. Occasionally now you sit before the fire grate of that life and stir up the smoldering embers. Whatever may have been the origin of this semi-paganism in these people of whom I write, they all have this one trait in common, a cold indifference towards Jesus Christ. This is a natural sequence, for since Jesus is the author and source of our supernatural life, it is from him and through him that it comes to us. Why should we be astonished, then, that a soul tainted by naturalism is indifferent towards Jesus Christ? How often have I heard people deploring their inability to approach near to Jesus, and expressing their envy of those who find in the love of the Master a food for the heart and a consolation in the hours of trial. The words and examples of Jesus have made no impression on these people. His sacred person, so real for many others, is to them a mere abstraction. In one word, Jesus is not a real being for them. What do those pages of the Gospel, read so assiduously by the devout, mean to them? Nothing. Their hearts do not vibrate at the recital of all that Jesus has done for them in his mortal life. What says the tabernacle to them? Hardly anything. Their faith is so weak, so little awakened. But what terror would seize them if the mask of indifference were torn off? If the God whom they carry in them after communion should suddenly reveal himself as he really is, so good, so tender, so compassionate, all glorious and resplendent with light. How confounded and humiliated they would be at their want of appreciation for Christ's great majesty. How profoundly would they reproach themselves for having been indifferent to such love and for returning nothing for it save a distracted thanks. Now these honest pagans, who I am describing, are wont to despair of themselves and to imagine that the Christian sense is wanting in them, just as certain persons are wanting in appreciation for music and poetry. Consequently, they are led to believe that whatever they do, this Christian sense will never awaken in them. I rejoice to be able to fill them with hope and to assure them that they possess this treasure, though it lies buried under a debris of negligence, venial faults, and unchristian habits. Since they are in the state of grace, they have a true love of Jesus in the depths of their souls. A very passive love, it is true, but a love that is real nevertheless. To awaken this love and to make it active is within the reach of everyone. The important thing is to proceed with method and to submit with docility to the treatment which we shall soon advise. There is very little to despair of in these people because they often possess precious natural qualities. Indeed, many of them are capable of great things. They perhaps will never go out of their way to adopt a religious practice which is not commanded, or to work with a view to their own personal sanctification. But the day wherein they will have recognized Jesus, the day wherein they will have comprehended the immense love of Jesus, the day wherein Jesus will have become a real being for them, on that day all the energy that they have wasted on creatures will find its place in the supernatural life and bloom into Christian virtues. Oh, how often have such people, after shaking off their semi-paganism, accomplished great things in the spiritual life. Chapter 4, The Value of Time. What good reasons we have for valuing our time in making good use of it. The few years which God gives us to live, enclosed as they are between the centuries that are gone and those that are to come, are indeed a trifle compared with eternity. Regarded from this standpoint, our life resembles that of those insects called, I believe, ephemera. They are born in the morning, and in the evening they have ceased to exist. Better yet, our life resembles a wave, washed up by the wind on the bosom of the sea, that scintillates an instant under the rays of the sun and then falls back and is no more. Or again, it is like to those flashes of lightning which, on a stormy night, dazzle the eye for a moment and then disappear without leaving a trace of their existence. And this inconceivable rapidity, this nothingness of human life, condemns at once all the ambitions and desires which attach us to the earth. What folly, then, when we consider the brevity of life, to dream of cutting a great figure here below, to yearn for the admiration of the world, and to attach our hearts to those earthly goods from which we shall be so brutally separated on the morrow. All this is truth itself. These thoughts are truly Christian thoughts. The pleasures of life could not seduce the holy men who sounded the vanity of those earthly attractions which captivate the worldling. But so far we have considered only one side of the question. Though life is brief, it is at the same time a treasure, the most precious of all treasures. Americans have an adage which well expresses their principal preoccupation. Time, they say, is money. Let us adopt this adage, but let us Christianize it and say, time is the money with which we can purchase eternity. Yes, it is during our fleeting existence here that our eternal destiny must be decided. It is on the employment of these few days which we have to live that our eternal lot depends. Hence how important it is for us to realize the value of time and use it to advantage. Each one of the instants of which it is composed, if we employ them according to the will of God, is the small coin with which we can purchase a superior degree of glory in heaven. Yes, the present moment, which to all appearance is such a trifle, and which to mind is but the lightning flash, this moment, if I utilize it according to the designs of God, will give me a more intimate possession of God, and a more entrancing communion with Him for all eternity. Why be astonished, then, that the Holy Spirit places so much insistence on the good employment of our time? I should never end were I to repeat to you all the passages of Holy Writ in which we are exhorted not to lose a moment of our time. I shall confine myself to these short extracts. Son, observe the time and fly from evil. Ecclesiasticus 4, verse 23. Therefore, whilst we have time, let us do good. Galatians 6, verse 10. Need we be astonished at the fidelity with which the saints have put their maxims into practice? I defy anyone to find even one of them who did not employ his time to the best advantage. Are not holiness and the proper employment of time intimately related, then? A saint who would have trifled with time, who would have squandered it or thrown it to the winds of vanity or frivolity, would be one whom we might well ridicule, and you yourselves would politely invite him to descend from a pedestal to which he had no right. St. Francis Borgia, when he was yet in the world, thus answered those who sought to have him devote a part of his time to the vanities of social life. Let me alone, for I prefer to pass for a common person rather than lose my time. St. Alphonsus bound himself by a vow never to lose a moment of time. And it is this vow that accounts for the wonderful works of this saint. It was this vow that enabled him to accomplish by word and example a sum of work that appears to us beyond the power of man. Others there are, my daughters, who appreciate the value of time, but alas, too late. These people are at this moment in hell. What would they not give could they have but 1 hour in which to do penance? Listen to the expression of their regret. I had ample time when I was on earth to save my soul and prepare for myself a place in heaven, but I foolishly squandered it. I employed it in the pursuit of vain phantoms which men call pleasures, riches, and honors. All these in turn were mine, but they left me, when perchance I had attained them, naught save emptiness, deception, and chagrin. While on earth I was ignorant of true happiness, and behold, I shall be ignorant of it throughout all eternity. Oh, for 1 moment of that time which I have so foolishly squandered! And lo, like to a mocking echo, the voice of the demon responds, Too late, too late! For you time is no more. You have lavished your time on all the vanities with which I have tempted you. Attain these, I said, and you will be happy. Fool, well may you weep over your folly. My daughters, if the elect of heaven could experience regret, it would be a regret for the loss of time, and if they could form a desire, that desire would be for a few moments of time. A pious Benedictine, appearing after his death to one of his companions, said to him that he was indeed perfectly happy, but that if he were able to desire anything, it would be to return to earth so that he might make a better use of his time, and thus secure a higher degree of glory in heaven. Let us consider now, my daughters, the various ways in which we are losing time. By remaining inactive, by permitting ourselves to be idle, and by indulging in daydreams. To squander our time in this fashion means to render our lives sterile and talent unproductive. We become like to the fig tree cursed by our Savior because it bore no fruit. Moreover, what ought we to think of those things which we do, according to the accepted expression, to kill time? Are not occupations of this kind equivalent to a loss of time? To deliver ourselves up to useless babbling, to waste an afternoon in visiting without some good purpose, to read dangerous novels, though they be of great literary excellence, to fill our minds with the refuse of newspapers, all this I grant an occupation. But occupations of this kind are, rightly understood, a real loss of time. Behold now another way in which we lose time. by amusing ourselves, not for the sake of refreshment or relaxation after work, but independently of all work, merely to pass away the time pleasurably. This immoderate desire for pleasure is one of the temptations of riches, and one of the reasons, doubtless, which led our Savior to say that it is exceedingly difficult for a rich man to enter into the kingdom of heaven. I often recall the text which Cardinal Longanieu chose when preaching a Lenten sermon at the Tuileries in the reign of Napoleon III. This venerable and saintly man chose no other words than those which were repeated every morning in this frivolous court of the Third Empire. How shall we amuse ourselves today? Self-amusement was the great end of the lives of these courtiers. Take care, my daughters, that you do not bring into your lives something of these deplorable manners, and remember well that to run after pleasure is to lose the true life. Let us consider, finally, one more way in which we lose time, by doing something other than that which we ought to do. You yield, for example, to a temptation to make some fancy work during the time set apart for an exercise of piety. You are not at all inactive during this time, nor could you be accused of idleness. But you are losing your time, nevertheless, by employing it in a manner contrary to the actual design of God. What resolutions should we adopt, then, in the face of these considerations? First, I shall never remain idle, nor lose one single instant of my time. Second, I shall draw up for myself a rule of life, adapted to my state, comprising only a few articles, and capable of being applied to the diverse circumstance of my life. I shall ask myself every morning if I have observed this rule in all its essentials. Third, I shall be faithful to the following rule, which, so to speak, multiplies time and permits even the busiest person to find time for everything. The rule is, I shall never put off what I can do now. Chapter 5. The Need of a Rule of Life. One of the resolutions which I suggested in the preceding chapter was fidelity to a rule of life. Have you a rule of life? Do not say that a rule is possible for a religious, but impossible for the mother of a family. This is an error. Every woman, whatever her lot in life, and whatever her obligations, ought to have a rule of life. Of course, the rule of a religious will be less open to modification, and will entail greater precision and severity than yours. Nevertheless, you must have a rule. Otherwise, your life will be squandered in 1,000 follies and futilities. Need this rule be written? When written, it will have much more precision than if it were only in the memory. But do not imagine that it should cover many sheets of paper. A few simple resolutions, clearly stated, will be entirely sufficient. You need not overburden yourselves in the beginning. Go forward step by step. A rule is not immutable. We can always add to it according as divine grace directs us. Indeed, it is better to add to a rule than to subtract from it. It is better to begin at a moderate pace than to be obliged to slacken our pace and perhaps lose heart. Let me call your attention to the advantages of a rule of life. First, it saves you from yourselves, so to speak, from the spirit of caprice which finds its way so easily into your actions and robs you of the greater part of your merit. We are all tempted to do only what pleases us, and to avoid sacrifices as much as possible. An act needs but to take on the appearance of duty to become an object of aversion to us. The result is that unless you are bound by a rule, your lives will drift unceasingly. They will float along, guided only by caprice, and the sense of duty will be almost entirely lost. In that case, it is your own will that you have followed from morning until evening, and not the will of God. From the viewpoint of merit, what a sad life is that which is not regulated. It is a life which, from a worldly standpoint, may have a certain respectability, but which, from the supernatural side, is a mere farce. Will you tell me what the day weighs in the divine balance during which you follow your own will with never a thought of the will of God? The evil of our century is precisely the absence of the supernatural in life. It is this naturalism, this worldliness, that draws Christian souls back to the ideals which honest pagans formerly conceived at Rome or at Athens. Do you imagine that you can combat this naturalism by leaving your life unbridled? so to speak, without a bit to restrain it or a rule to regulate it? I have no hesitancy in saying that a life without a rule is the life wherein the supernatural, that is, the part of God, has little or no importance. Here is another advantage of a rule of life. There are many bound by a rule whose lives are very fruitful. She who lives by a rule finds time for everything. Such a life produces its effects much more quickly and with less fatigue than a life without a rule. Ask any Christian mother who accomplishes an astonishing amount of work, yet never has an air of depression. Ask her, I say, the secret of her activity. She will tell you that she works methodically because she is guided by her rule. Others, though always occupied, accomplish little because they follow the inspiration of the moment. When perchance they have finished a work, they lose a quarter of an hour asking themselves what to do next. Then they attempt something, leave it unachieved because it has suddenly become distasteful to them, pass to another work, return finally to the first, and in the end accomplish nothing. True, they have been occupied continually, but they have been badly occupied, and have succeeded in making everyone around them discontented. Now the ridiculous part of it all is this, that instead of laying the fault to themselves, they feign to be misunderstood and accuse their husbands of not rendering justice to their tact. If you desire me to draw up for you the essentials of your rule, I will say that you should first determine the hour of your rising and retiring. Do not remain undecided on this important point. The rule extolled by spiritual writers as well as by physicians is to retire early in order to rise early. Here's another article that ought to find its place in your rule. Morning and evening prayers should be said kneeling. Moreover, there's hardly one among you who cannot spend a quarter of an hour each day in spiritual reading. You should have a special article binding you to that. Those of you who have time and who are unwilling to be satisfied with merely earthly piety ought to take measures to make a meditation every morning, and also to attend Holy Mass each day, or at least several times during the week. Do not forget to receive the sacraments. But of all the articles, this will be the most subject to modification. The more often you communicate, the more ardent will your desire for the Holy Eucharist become. It will be necessary, therefore, to modify your rule more and more frequently in regard to the reception of the sacraments. I will propose this rule for the distribution of your time. Give your attention above all to the most important duties, I mean those of your interior and station in life. Then attend to the less important duties. The remainder of your time may be spent on duties of pure decorum, if any more time remains. Since your rule has been made for God, it is for God that it should be followed out. This rule is the expression of the will of God in your regard, which must of necessity be very dear to you. Bring then to the accomplishment of each of these articles a true spirit of faith and a truly supernatural motive, and place yourself always 100 times daily under the eye of God, saying frequently to him with love, "All for thee, my God." Chapter 6, Promptness in Rising. I shall discuss in this chapter a very practical subject, a subject demanding serious consideration. I refer to promptness in rising. I have just informed you that this subject is very practical. I must add that it is very important. The truly spiritual life is absolutely impossible for her who is irregular in rising. If you say that you do not exert yourselves overmuch to be exact on this point, I know what to think of your exercises of piety. You probably omit them often for want of time, or perform them languidly and mechanically. But surely, my daughters, you all rise at an early hour. You are not given over to a habit of laziness. Moreover, instead of insisting on exactness and promptness in rising, I believe it is far more useful to state a few practical rules to which you should conform. First of all, rise at a fixed hour. Decide on the time and examine well into the effect your early rising will have on your general health and temperament. But once this hour is fixed, make no exceptions to it, save only when sickness or extraordinary circumstances render them necessary. How many hours of sleep are necessary? Physicians advise 7 hours for a robust person, but among religious communities, generally 8 hours are allowed. You may adopt this rule, but do not exceed 8 hours. You would be yielding to weakness and sensuality. A prolonged sleep will not deliver you from any indisposition, which very often is more imaginary than real. You complain of feeling ill at awakening, and it seems that to raise your head from the pillow is a sacrifice beyond your strength. Pay no attention to this temptation. Give the enemy no quarter. Rise up at once, and you will feel that your complaint was imaginary. The ancients were wont to say that life consists in movement. You will experience the truth of these words, and you will learn how to mount to a degree of activity which you thought impossible. Rise early. This slogan holds the secret of a complete and perfect life. By rising early, the best hours of the day will be yours, hours when the mind is clear, hours well suited for meditation. If, on the contrary, you defer your rising, an irremediable disorganization will continue throughout the day from this first fault. The intellectual and moral life of a person who rises late, Pere Olivant was wont to say, is seized by an impotency like to that of the Romans at Capua. Hence the words of Holy Scripture, "My son, love not sleep, lest poverty overtake thee." Poverty? Yes, but not so much in the sense of material goods as that of the mind and heart. How much I desire to picture to your minds types of those stolid Christians of the early days with their habits of virility and courage.